Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The so-called Golden State Killer, raped and murdered for a decade, repeatedly eluding police until the case went cold in the mid-80s. 4 decades later, police have arrested a suspect in the case after investigators plugged stored DNA from past crime scenes into an online genealogy database. The capture has been celebrated, but the process by which it was achieved has raised ethical questions, specifically if the DNA evidence should be allowed without consent. New York Times San Francisco Bureau Chief Thomas Fuller has been covering this story. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks.
So, Thomas, first tell us about the Golden State Killer, who he is or who he was, for those of us who aren't as plugged in.
So this was a person who really terrified the Sacramento area and then Southern California, the East Bay of San Francisco. It was really terrorism before we called it that. I mean, he would go in a neighborhood from, house to house over a period of years. It was a 12-year raping and killing spree, and people bought guns in droves. They bought deadbolts. They had community meetings where they were just anguished as to how they could protect themselves from him. It was something that really terrified California, and became known as the East Area rapist, and also the Golden State Killer, and a number of other names. But it was the entire state that was terrifying.
Was he ever close to being captured? Did he leave any clues? Did they ever think they were going to get him?
Well, so it was, the definition of a cold case since 1986. Mm-hmm. They had around 2000, they made links between DNA samples from the rape kits. And so they knew that this was the same person, or they assumed that this was the same person from the DNA. But they were never very close. With hindsight, we see that the man who was arrested last week, Joseph James D'Angelo, and is accused by the authorities of being the Golden State Killer, he was a former police officer who was arrested in the late 70s for shoplifting and fired as a police officer. So he did have a run-in with the law, but that connection was never made until last week.
Tell us how they used a genealogy site to identify him.
So they came up with the idea last year. They said, look, we have this DNA. Why don't we plug it into a genealogy site and see if we can build a family tree? They ran into a snafu because a lot of their samples had degraded over the years. So they had a breakthrough because one of the medical examiners in Southern California kept a second sample that was pristine, that was unopened. He had a habit of keeping two samples from each crime scene. So they used that pristine DNA to create a profile. And then they uploaded that profile into a lesser known service, which is called GEDmatch. It's a website. You upload your profile, and they came up with a family tree. It took about 4 months. They consulted with genealogists, and they went through all the people on this family tree. I mean, the first hit was a very distant relative. And then they came across this former police officer who lived in the Sacramento area. He was the right age. They went and collected his DNA. The authorities haven't told us exactly how. But it was something like collected it from his garbage, or they call it discarded DNA. So they made a match between the DNA from the crime scenes and the DNA that they collected, and they did it again. and to be sure, and they say it's a full match.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Thomas Fuller. He's bureau chief for the New York Times and the San Francisco Bureau. And we're talking about how law enforcement used a genealogy site to catch the suspect who's believed to be the Golden State Killer. Conducted a 12-year reign of terror on the state of California, raping many people, dozens of women, murdering many. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Thomas Fuller, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Has this ever been done before, anything like that that you know of, to solve a crime?
You know, we heard of one other case that had been solved like in this way, but this is certainly the first high-profile case, and it was seen by the investigators as something quite innovative.
So, what are the ethical concerns in conducting an investigation in this way? What's the problem with what they did, or what do some people think the problem is?
Well, some people are concerned about privacy. In order to conduct the searches on the genealogy site, the investigators had to create a fake profile. They had to use a pseudonym, they would reach out to family members and say, you know, here we're trying to put together this. I don't know exactly what they said, but this was all done as if they were looking for a lost relative. So I think those are the concerns. The sheriff involved in this case, Sacramento County, says, look, this is, we got our man, and this is for society to debate later whether or not it was appropriate. But, we've found this man who killed 12 people and raped more than 50.
Has anyone complained who was, interviewed along during that 4-month period that they were tracking the DNA match?
Not that I'm aware of. We've reached out to relatives. Obviously, the close relatives are described to be very shocked. You can imagine he had daughters, an estranged wife, and the presumption by the sheriff is that they did not know about his past, and his, I guess we should say, his alleged past. Mm-hmm. We haven't heard from, any relatives who felt taken advantage of or duped.
Are there laws that cover the use of DNA evidence and that would, or is there some, departure point for guidance on this issue?
I'm not aware of them. I mean, this is such a new frontier in terms of, crime work using the genealogy sites. I mean, there are the terms and conditions of the sites themselves. One interesting wrinkle there is that people are, because of privacy concerns, people are allowed to post their DNA using kind of a screen name or a pseudonym. Because people want privacy, they don't want others to be able to search for them while they're searching. Mm-hmm. You have this kind of ironic situation that the authorities were doing something that the site allows because of privacy.
So he had never actually registered his DNA with this site, right?
He never did, as far as we know. This was a killer who was considered very meticulous and very demonically clever. I think he probably knew, as a former police officer, that they would have these DNA samples. So I think it's very unlikely that he would have submitted, sent away a cheek swab to 23andMe. But his, you know, the investigators have said that the people who came up in their searches, his relatives, were very distant relatives. So a lot of the work that had to be done after the uploading of the genetic profile was kind of, you know, old-fashioned, you know, let's look at this range of suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at this big family tree and, you know, let's expand it further. It was a four-month, that alone was a four-month process.
You know, as a journalist, it just sounds fascinating to me, this whole new realm of inquiry that's out there now. Have the genealogy sites had a response, or have they commented on this? Are they worried that maybe people won't be registering as much?
Well, the genealogy, I mean, like 23andMe and genealogy.com, they were very quick to say we did not, you know, cooperate with the authorities, and there's no indication that they did. This was something that the researchers did, you know, posing as users.
Mm-hmm. And so it's typical for people to, I've actually never been on one of these sites before. It's typical for people to have an anonymous kind of a handle that they can be identified by, but not to reveal who they really are until they've, you know, gotten whatever kind of confirmation they need. So there's no way for the sites to avoid this.
Well, the terms and conditions of GEDmatch, which is the site that the investigators used, they say that you should put your real name in the connected to the profile that you're submitting, but then you can use a pseudonym or a screen name that others will, that the public will see. So they make that distinction.
I have to wonder, there must be other law enforcement agencies out there that are getting a lot of bright ideas from this.
Well, and this is, I think, just the beginning. Maybe with this case, I mean, there was a man who was in prison for several decades in Southern California, who was exonerated and released from prison earlier this year. And the authorities in the county where the crime occurred say, "Well, now we're going to check our records and see if there's a match with the Golden State Killer here." So, I mean, this could be very consequential going forward.
Do we know anything about, did he stop killing and murdering in 1986 or 87, whenever that was, when it went cold? Is that because he stopped?
That's a real open question. I mean, there is no there's no DNA evidence after 1986, but which is around the same time that he had his first child.
Huh.
But investigators are now looking into whether he was active, because you know, if any crimes were committed afterwards. I mean, a lot of people have asked the question, you know, is that plausible that someone who for 12 years would be you know, would be conducting these very sick crimes, can you just sort of, do you just stop on a dime like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas Fuller, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I appreciate it.
No, you're welcome.
It's Thomas Fuller. He's San Francisco bureau chief for the New York Times. He's been covering the case of the Golden State Killer. Authorities have identified a prime suspect now, finally, after four decades, by using a genealogy site to match the DNA they had collected at the crime scenes over the years. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When it comes to social media, some of us hit send too quickly. That includes federal bureaucrats. And as more and more public records are digitized, there is growing concern about how government policies manage those records. Military policy researcher at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication, Mira McCammon, recently wrote about the issue for Slate. We'll post a link to that story on our website at WOSU.org/all sides. Mira McCammon joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for having me on.
Your story isn't about the Trump administration per se at all. The president's tweets will always be with us. Who are we talking about here? What are we talking about?
Yeah. So, you know, I actually started researching deleted tweets long before Trump was elected. And so the account that I was drawn to initially was at JTFGTMO. It's a clunker of a Twitter handle, but it's the account run by the Joint Task Force of Guantanamo, which is the body that governs the detention facilities. I noticed that they were going on a very big deletion binge, and that got me thinking about, you know, what other federal agencies were doing, and more importantly, like, what was stopping them from deleting. And so, you know, when I started to think about federal agencies, I thought, oh, well, you know, maybe there's like 200. And I thought, like, oh, well, there's at CIA. Everyone likes to joke about the fact that the CIA has a Twitter account. And
I follow them.
They've got a lot of followers.
Uh-huh.
And then I started, you know, creating this list. And as I went through, you know, I wasn't ever taught like how many federal agencies there even are. Mm-hmm. And there are sub-agencies and, you know, every national park, it feels like, has its own Twitter account. And I didn't know any of these things. And so before too much time had passed, I had thousands of Twitter handles that, you know, were all associated with federal agencies. And so that's what got me started on this journey.
You know, it's kind of, I'm trying to think about the magnitude of the issue. When we're following, I said the president's tweets will always be with us because somebody follows that, and him and other people, everyone, you know, yeah. Anyone famous, anyone notorious, blah, blah, blah. They're being followed. You mentioned by, there's different services that do that.
Yeah.
One you mentioned is Politiwhoops.
Yeah. I think they go by Politiwhoops, but I like
Oh,
the
sorry.
Way said it as well. No,
Politiwhoops sounds better.
It does.
Yeah.
So Politiwhoops has been in this for a while, and they have done a fabulous job of tracking tweets, not just by the president, but also by, you know, elected officials more broadly. You know, the problem is that it's a big operation to try to keep track of thousands of federal agencies' Twitter handles and mm-hmm. what they're deleting. And, you know, one of the reasons why I think people care a lot about what elected officials are tweeting and deleting is because it's done under the auspices that they themselves are tweeting and deleting, even though it might be their interns. You know, it's still tied to their face. You see their face on the profile, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, when it comes to these federal agency Twitter feeds, like, you know, one of my favorites is like at Naval OPSEC, and it's trying to advise people in the Navy what they can talk about and what they can disclose. And they have this great banner art which says, "Watch what you say in public. You never know who might be listening." But there's, you know, there's no face tied to the account. And so how do you, you know, it's a different sort of communications process when you can't, you know, tie a face to the account, I think. And
Well, I mean, in the olden days, there was a spokesperson or a communications director for an agency
right.
that I would go to, but it could be anyone, or it could be even something that's automated.
Right. And so, you know, that's a really good point. You know, some of these accounts are just effectively links to Facebook pages. And then some of them are just chock full of original content and really do feel like, you know, appendages of the PR operations of any specific agency. And so what's important to know here is that, you know, some of these are just vibrant, rich, updated daily, hourly. You know, they're tweeting back and forth with followers, and then there's some that are just like so quiet. And so, you know, it's hard to make broad statements about, you know, the value of all of the tweets as a collective. But still, you know, one of the challenges and something that I focus on in my pieces for Slate is that there is no single policy really. Mm-hmm. Across all of these federal agencies dictating what constitutes a federal record and what does not when it comes to social media accounts. And so that means that federal agencies themselves are deciding what to keep and what to delete. And that's where things get really messy because a lot of these agencies, based on, you know, I filed a bunch of Freedom of Information Act requests, basically asking agencies for records of their deleted tweets. And a lot of times agencies will get back to me and they'll actually say in the letter that they give me, well, we tried calling Twitter to get our deleted tweets back and they don't have them anymore. Which, you know, is fun because then I feel like I'm educating these federal agencies about how Twitter works. Yeah.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and we are talking about, you know, the Twitter policies, who tweets what and what gets detweeted or untweeted among federal agencies. My guest is Mira McCammon. She's a Slate contributor and military policy researcher at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. There is a Federal Records Act, though, right? I mean, why? I guess it's kind of shocking that there's no policy. Every company has a policy nowadays on social media. Why not the federal government?
Yeah, so the Federal Records Act is a wonderful, I like to call it a labyrinthine thing. It's complicated, and it ultimately gives agencies a good amount of freedom to decide, you know, how to handle social media accounts. And, you know, one of the comments that I encounter sometimes is, well, you know, federal agencies, they can't archive everything. Just like, you know, you or I can't keep everything in our lives forever, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there are limits to what is technologically possible. And, you know, that's a very good point, I think, but it still raises questions about the differing attitudes across all of these agencies. You know, I heard from one agency and, you know, they were like, well, we have had one person managing all of our social media accounts since we started to have them, and he has never deleted anything. And I thought to myself, well, you know, that's comforting to some extent, but what about when he leaves? You know, mm-hmm. what new rules might be implemented internally that you or I might not know about just because it, you know, someone's just new to the job?
You said you made a Freedom of Information request to the Department of Justice. What did you ask for and how did they respond?
Yeah, you know, so one of the things that I have been doing is I've taken the same template, the same Freedom of Information Act request, and I've just adopted it to accommodate for, you know, the differing Twitter handles and, you know, basically asking for the complete range of tweets. So, for example, some of these accounts, you know, have opened up at different points in time. And I ask for records of deleted tweets, but I also ask for emails related to the deletion and drafting of tweets.
In other words, the origin of the decision.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the origin, because, you know, some agencies, right, they actually will draft and vet and proof the tweets. And then some agencies just wing it. And, you know, so there aren't, you know, some agencies will drop like hundreds of pages of PDFs on me. And then others, like the Department of Justice, will say, oh, well, what you're asking for is very complicated. So we have to put you in a different track, and it's going to take a very long time. And, you know, sometimes I'll write and I'll say, well, hey, you know, the Office of Government Ethics, they were super speedy and they gave me hundreds of pages of PDFs. And you're saying this is too complicated? What's going on your end? So I've really enjoyed this process, even though it has been frustrating at times.
How long have you been working on this?
That's a good question. maybe some would say far too long. I started out in August 2016, really, really digging into deleted tweets. And then, you know, it was just an interest that evolved. And, you know, weirdly, we had this this moment when federal agencies were getting a lot of coverage in the news for deleting tweets, some of which were related to Trump. And, you know, it made me more curious to try to uncover the archive of, you know, how did these agencies act before Trump, you know? And the truth is that many of them deleted tweets before Trump became president. Deletion is not, you know, just something entirely new to the world. It's, it's a practice that has been part of our federal government for a long time. And, you know, I started filing these Freedom of Information Act requests, but then I also teamed up with Rhizome, which is this collective in New York, and they've created this really cool web archiving tool. And so what I've been doing is creating these miniature web archives of each of these federal agency Twitter feeds, partially out of interest and fear that more tweets might be deleted. And it's almost become a bit of an artistic project because I've become aware of the fact that there aren't many people doing, I haven't found many people doing the work that I'm doing. And so I feel happy about that.
Well, who or what else is keeping track of these deleted tweets? Anybody besides you?
You know, that's a great question. there's a small community of people who do care. A lot of them are web archivists. You know, sometimes journalists will write pieces, and I see a lot of pieces that are that will say things along the lines of, "Oh, you know, the Department of this sub agency of the Department of Education has not tweeted since Trump came to power." That must just mean that they don't do anything anymore. And I think that it's really interesting to put a spotlight on silence on social media accounts. But I also think that there's a real need to dig deeper into how federal agencies tweet across the years. You know, the Department of Justice is tweeting under Trump. They were tweeting under Obama. And I'm really interested in digging into, you know, what differences in tone, in content, in ideology can we see across time, and not just, oh, this one account, you know, they stopped tweeting. Because inevitably, you know, many of these accounts that stop tweeting, you know, they start tweeting again. And, you know, there's a lot of rotation and things that we can't necessarily see behind the scenes, and I'm trying to get at that in some of my work.
Are the administrators of Twitter accounts public record?
Are the names?
Yeah.
that is also a really interesting question. You know, they do pop up in some of the FOIA requests that I file. I'm able to get, I haven't asked specifically in my requests for names, but they do surface in a lot of the paperwork that I get. You know, they're out of the over 3,000 accounts that I have looked at. There are only a few that will, in their profile, actually say, you know, this account is run by Carrie. You know, but it will always be a first name, which
makes
it, makes it kind of challenging. And I mean, you know, we can broaden this analysis to talk about how organizations use Twitter, how mm-hmm. companies use Twitter. You know, if you go to 3M's Twitter feed, you're not going to see, you know, that it's run by, you know, at first name, last name. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I see some poetry journals mm-hmm. and they will say, you know, edited by, you know, they're very big into the process of
crediting.
Crediting, mm-hmm. exactly. And so this gets into, you know, bigger questions, I think, about labor and anonymity and invisibility. And, you know, do we need to know who's running these accounts? You know, what does it mean for big companies, right, that that even though their workforce is constantly rotating and undoubtedly some of their social media management is changing every year, that, you know, they're trying to project stability. And to some extent, I think that's what a lot of these federal agencies are trying to do as well. It would look a little funky if, you know, if the person managing the account changed every few weeks. But mm-hmm. I mean, at the same time, I have these dreams, these weird, quirky dreams sometimes. I think it'd be really fun if, like, at CIA was just, like, hosted by a different CIA employee every week, right? Like, that would shed light into what they do. I don't expect at CIA to consider that that idea. But, you know, if you think about it.
No, kind of like being forced, the person in the newsroom being forced to go to the editorial board meeting once a week. You know, people have to take turns doing that kind of a thing. Yeah, I see what
that's
you're saying.
Lot, you know?
But, you know, I ultimately don't care who's running the Twitter site for General Motors, but that's because they're not spending my tax money.
Right.
I guess I do care as a taxpayer, as, you know, who's running the sites for the federal government or for any government.
I'm so comforted to hear that, right? Because some people will say alternatively, you know, why should I really, you know, why should I care at all about these federal agency Twitter feeds? You know, I have friends who are very active on Twitter and are not interested at all in, you know, in what anyone is tweeting. You know, and that gets at the point that, you know, some of these federal agency Twitter feeds are geared towards very specific audiences, mm-hmm. you know, particularly, you know, when it comes to the military. You know, there are all of these Veterans Affairs Twitter feeds, which are geared towards, you know, veterans and their families, or, you know, people who are deployed with specific military bases. And so it's comforting to me to hear that you want to know more about these.
I feel like I should be able to find out if I want to find out.
I feel that too.
That's all. I'm not sure I'll ever ask, but if I want to ask, I should be able to find out, because I'm a FOIA, you know, I'm a kindred spirit when it comes to FOIA. So, you know, all journalists are. Well, gosh, we're running out of time, Mira. I gotta let you go. Thank you so much. We'll have a link to Mira McCammon's story about this issue of Twitter sites and who manages the Twitter and what's getting deleted and what's not, and how are we ever going to find out anyway in the federal government. She wrote for Slate. She's a Slate contributor. We'll have a link to that story on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Mira, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mira McCammon. We'll continue Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The third and fourth largest phone service carriers in the United States, Sprint and T-Mobile, are set to merge. The planned merger comes 6 years after AT&T's failed acquisition of T-Mobile. This may sound like good news for consumers, but Android Central Managing Editor Daniel Bader is cautious. He recently wrote about the issue. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Daniel Bader joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
How did the ball get rolling on a potential merger?
Well, this merger has been in the works for nearly 4 years now. We heard that T-Mobile and Sprint wanted to merge 3 years after the failed acquisition of T-Mobile by AT&T. And that was because T-Mobile at that point had gained significant traction in the market by not only undercutting AT&T and Verizon in terms of price, but really investing in its network and adding value to those plans, the plans that we pay so much for every month. For example, Netflix is a free Netflix subscription is given away with many of T-Mobile's plans. The company also tries to incentivize customers to be part of what it calls the T-Mobile Tuesday community. Every Tuesday, it gives away a whole bunch of freebies. These are the kinds of things that get customers excited about being a T-Mobile customer. And Sprint, on the other hand, has been struggling. It's got over $30 billion of debt after investing in a network that has had a lot of trouble since the company invested in the wrong kinds of high-speed wireless internet back in the late 2000s. So, the two companies make sense merging, but there are a lot of concerns about diminished competition in the U.S. market.
So the T-Mobile and the AT&T merge fell through, and it was because T-Mobile, I'm still not making the connection. Why did they fall apart and Sprint and T-Mobile look like a plan?
Well, it wasn't a merger. So it was an acquisition
by
AT&T. AT&T wanted T-Mobile because of not only its customers, but because T-Mobile had been, at the time, was less of a threat for high-value customers, what we call postpaid customers, than prepaid customers. T-Mobile had an enormous prepaid market share, and it still does, but the company was an upstart, and as a result, AT&T wanted to eliminate that competition.
I got you.
The Obama FCC did not think that was a good idea. And at this point, under the Trump administration, Ajit Pai, the new chairman of the FCC, is much more amenable to these kinds of mergers and acquisitions.
And so that's why merge now. How will it affect phone service in general, anyway, in any particular way?
Well, at this point, we don't know. The merger is expected to increase the coverage of the unified network. T-Mobile and Sprint have very different coverage areas and areas of strength throughout the continental United States. And within 3 years, those networks will be merged and customers will expect much better service. That is an upside. Mm-hmm. The downside is that prices may go up as a result of diminished competition, even though CEO John Legere does not believe that to be the case. He believes that because of the buying power of these two companies coming together, the streamlined infrastructure and the intention to deploy what we call next generation 5G wireless technology before 2020, there will be lower costs as a result of this merger. But obviously, with diminished competition, that isn't a given.
Is that what you meant then when you wrote that what speaks the loudest are the things unsaid here?
Well, what's being said exactly? What's being said publicly is that not only will this be an upside for shareholders thanks to $6 billion in efficiencies due to, you know, when these two companies come together, but that the costs will be lowered because these two companies will have such high buying power and will be able to invest more effectively in the networks, in the network infrastructure that both companies are separately paying for at this point. But unfortunately, because of, you know, there will be efficiencies and job cuts will be inevitable as a result, you know, there are things that these companies are promising that we know through previous consolidation in other industries. Look at the airline industry, for instance. Mm-hmm. It's unlikely to happen the way that they promise.
Has this been an issue that's been raised to the FCC, or is that just not a concern of theirs?
Well, the FCC believes that it shouldn't get in the way of good business and free markets. So obviously this will be raised. There are two Democrats on the FCC, and they will absolutely raise this. They will say that this is an even worse deal for consumers than a potential AT&T T-Mobile acquisition, largely because since that deal fell through, T-Mobile has been the only company in the United States pushing for lower prices and better service. And it's forced AT&T and Verizon to improve their networks considerably, especially since T-Mobile debuted an unlimited plan in February of 2017. And since then, both AT&T and Verizon have followed suit and have had to shore up their own networks as a result to compete.
So much of this hinges on the demand for 5G. Why? What's the connection there?
The 5G connection is enormous. T-Mobile and Sprint together say that they will better be able to compete with Chinese vendors, those that and Chinese companies that are trying to win the 5G race. 5G, it's a bit of a nebulous topic right now because we don't really know what businesses and what use cases will benefit most from that next generation wireless technology. But we do know that things like wireless, self-driving cars, lots of industry right now that relies not just on, you know, remote sensors, but wired connections. So when you think of large businesses that need fiber to their business, they are kind of tethered to the fact that they can't use wireless technology like our current 4G networks to perform at their peak. They will be able to then use these technologies wirelessly and move further away from their base. Think of oil and drilling, gas as a result. You know what they need for their oil wells, and as a result, T-Mobile and Sprint together believe that they can win that 5G race against many of the Chinese up-and-comers, and they're positioning that to the FCC.
When is this going to be resolved?
Well, we're not really sure. The companies say that the deal is going to be completed in the first half of 2019. Mm-hmm. So that may be delayed if the Justice Department wants to look into this further. But at this point, we're not sure.
Let's turn to Gmail. Everybody has a Gmail account now, right?
They absolutely.
For one reason or another. Why? They want to redesign it. Why does Google want to change Gmail?
Well, Gmail has been the most popular mail service. I'm sorry, Anne. I just had to walk away for a second.
Sure.
Gmail is probably the most popular email service that has ever existed, but it's really had quite a delay in terms of an overhaul. I apologize.
Are you okay, Daniel?
Oh, I'm totally fine. I am so sorry. Yes,
no,
Gmail has had a it's been one of those services that has had some delays in terms of a promised redesign. And there have been, you know, there have been so many people waiting for something like this, and it's taken a long time to come to fruition. So I'm so sorry.
Daniel,
let's move.
Okay.
Let's move on to this, to another topic.
Okay. Google's parent company, Alphabet, wants to diversify into other businesses. What is Alphabet?
So Alphabet is Google's parent company. It's the company that was essentially made in order to allow Google to focus on its core businesses, which is, you know, advertising. And while doing so allows other companies within the Alphabet parent, you know, Sergey Brin and Larry Page have wanted to move the company away from just relying on revenue from advertising for years. So Alphabet is now trying to do a whole lot more. We've seen it move into areas of you know, research and development around AI, around self-driving cars. We've seen the early results of a glucose measuring contact lens. Hmm. So these are the kinds of moonshot projects that Alphabet has been working on. But we also know that Google is the breadwinner within the company, and Google understands that it cannot rely exclusively on advertising-based revenue forever. And it's been moving into building hardware. We see things like Google Home and the Pixel phones and laptops.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, you know, Google has been able to better compete with competitors like Amazon because it's not just relying on that single business model, which until now has basically been 90 to 95% of its quarterly revenue.
Hmm. Before I let you go, I did want to talk about the new Amazon Echo Dot that has parental controls and a worry-free guarantee. I mean, all things being equal, I've been listening to, they're really working hard on making these, it's called the Echo Kids Dot. Tell us about it. What's new?
So the Amazon Echo Dot is at $40 is probably the most popular smart speaker in America. It's incredibly easy to set up, and you know, I don't want to say the hot word because everybody you know, listening, if they're not already mad at me, they're going to be even madder because all of their speakers are going to go set off. But the you know, this is the service that, you know, everybody loves, and Google understands this, which is the reason that it's moving so heavily into hardware. But you know, let's just look at the ecosystem here. Amazon has millions of these speakers in the home, and kids are using them even if these speakers are not optimized for that use case.
Mm-hmm.
So this kid's version allows for a couple things. It extends the warranty to 2 years from 1 year. So if it breaks, it'll get repaired. Not only that, but it's layered with sort of a rubberized protection in many different colors, so if you knock it off the shelf, it won't break.
Okay.
And it comes with an Amazon free time subscription, so kids can listen to audiobooks that are specially made for them. And this is just really a way for Amazon to get into more kids' rooms while allowing parents to feel comfortable that interaction is safe for them.
Okay. Well, Daniel Bader, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Daniel Bader, Managing Editor for Android Central. That's it for Tech Tuesday today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.